Hello, hello everyone. This is Dr. Eeks. Some of you know me as Dr. Aaron. I respond to either. Okay, so if you follow my blog, read my parody that I wrote, Yours in Wellness, or if you watch any of my videos, you'll know that I am critical of big pharma and industry's influence over medicine. I'm not saying that they're all bad, but they have a lot of power. And, you know, how I think healthcare providers being more critical of that influence instead of just being critical of, say, you know, quacks, is one way to rebuild trust in a broken system or a system that lacks trust especially between patients and providers, or how people view the medical system and the motivations behind it. I don't talk a lot about the influence over research, however, or the biomedical research agenda. And that's what we are going to talk about today. Joining me are three fabulous researchers and doctors: Dr. Mercedes Garcia Carrillo, Dr. Marc Andre Gagnon, and Dr. Cecilia Recap, who, along with other authors, and I'll post the paper, I'll post a link to their study so you can see who those authors are, wrote a paper called "Whose Shoulders is Health Research Standing On? Determining the Key Actors and Contents of the Prevailing Biomedical Research Agenda." And I'm going to include their bios in the podcast description and also on my website. Dr. Mercedes and Dr. Cecilia are calling in from Argentina, and Dr. Marc is calling in from Canada. So this is a great global perspective, a global podcast, which I love. So what are we going to talk about? Briefly, we're going to talk about what defines the dominant healthcare agenda, and why is that important? Because that is what is getting the most attention. It's getting talked about more. It's getting published in the top scientific journals, and it has the potential to influence policy and protocols. So it's very important. We're also going to talk about what's not included in the dominant research agenda, meaning what's not in those top journals or maybe not getting discussed as much. And also, what is industry's influence over this research agenda? And what improvements can be made so maybe it's less biased? And of course, we're going to talk a little bit about the pandemic, since we have a multi-country perspective and not just the U.S. this time. Of course, that's me. I'm in New York City. So yeah, let's just connect to these researchers and jump right in.
Don't forget... And I know we're all on like different time zones, so I think that's pretty cool.
Well, Erin, you're based in New York?
I am. I'm in New York City. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that's
okay,
a good...
Okay, so I'm in Ottawa, so we are in the same time zone.
We're in the same time zone, okay.
And Mercedes...
We're in the same time zone, and we're not too far. So Cecilia and Mercedes is... let's start there. If you guys want to, before we get into like the research that you guys did, which I think is really cool, and I'm really interested in this type of stuff for a lot of reasons, could you guys give like a brief kind of bio on like what, where you are, what you do? Whoever wants
sure.
to go first.
Mercedes, Matilde, you want to go first?
No, you can go first, Tessie.
Okay, so I'm Cecilia Recap. I'm a CONICET senior researcher. The CONICET is the National Research Council of Argentina. I'm also associate researcher of the CEPED, which is an interdisciplinary research center based at the Université de Paris, and also associate researcher of other institutions in Paris, where I did part of my research in the past. I come from economics. I'm an economist. I did my PhD also in economics. So my background is mostly on economics of science, technology, and innovation, and how through power relations, big corporations appropriate knowledge and profit.
Okay, cool. Who wants to go next? Mercedes, okay.
Yes, I can introduce myself. Well, my name is Mercedes Garcia Carrillo. Like Ceci mentioned, I'm also a biologist from Buenos Aires University, and I got my PhD in industrial chemistry with working with alternative methods of food preservation. But now I'm back working in molecular biology. Even Matthias' group actually works on the determinants that cause cells to become cancerous. We work on molecular biology of cancer. And my particular project for my postdoctoral grant is based on studying the effects of herbicides on human cells, especially on cell pathways.
Very cool. Okay, last but not least.
Well, Irene, so Marc-André Gagnon, I'm a professor of public policy at the Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. I just want to mention that the picture you just saw, I'm sorry it was there, it was for basically another meeting I had. I was welcoming a philosopher that taught me when I was an undergrad student, and I wanted to give him a picture of when I was an undergrad student. So my focus has been the political economy of the pharmaceutical sector. So I'm looking a lot on corporate practices to influence prescribing habits, to influence science when it comes to pharmaceuticals. And I'm also analyze health insurance programs, pharmacare program, basically. So all the issues about drug coverage, basically how do you organize the market for prescription drugs in terms of supply and demand.
Very cool. Okay, so you guys all authored this paper that I read. Whose shoulders is health research standing on? So this is about HBMS, Health Biomedical Sciences Research Agenda, and kind of what gets published, basically. And we know that kind of what gets published sets the standards of care and can often dictate, at least what dictates what people focus on. And so I want to talk a little bit, you guys talk a lot about the skewing problem, but first, maybe just for my listeners, and just so you know, my listeners don't always have like a big scientific background. So just kind of like regular people with no scientific background, maybe like, could somebody define what you mean by research agenda?
I can take a stab with this one if you want. So, maybe the first thing we need to do is contrast what this study does as compared to other studies that have been looking on issues of conflict of interest. So basically, what we do know already is that every time you have corporate money funding specific research, normally this research is kind of skewed in favor of the interests of the sponsor. So this is something that we know. Another thing that that have been analyzed as well in terms of research agenda, so it's a bit different. So it's not about specific research, it's about setting the agenda. So basically the long-term research, what are the specific research niche that are becoming more important? And what we saw is, so in different industrial sectors, sometimes there's a lot of money being poured in by the industry in order to influence the research agenda. So we can think about the Monsanto papers, so how to do the research about GMOs. You can look at the sugar papers, so basically in terms of nutrition, how we focus on fat being the problem. So this way of skewing research agenda, okay, let's focus on this specific issue and forget about the other issue. We know already that when the industry is financing research, sometimes they have an impact on research agendas. The question we were asking here was a bit different in the sense that it's not the question is not, well, when the industry is funding the research, does it create skewing bias or is it shaping the research agenda? Yes, we know it does. What we're asking here is let's have a look at what is the dominant research agenda in biomedical research. And from there, let's try to find out if the industry have managed to become central in shaping not research agendas, but the dominant research agenda based on the bibliometric measures used in biomedical sciences. So basically the old methods about mapping the networks.
Right.
It's okay, let's define what are the dominant research agendas, and then let's try to see if industry has an important influence on setting what becomes dominant here.
Okay.
Just to add, for someone that it's the first time that listens to the word or to the term research agenda, think of the most important topics within a discipline. It's the topics that that most of the people want to work on. The most influential ones are those that become part of this dominant research agenda. And one may think, okay, this may be a result of a somehow anarchic process where everyone decides freely what to do research on. And after that, and a dominant research agenda emerges like bottom up. But actually what we are trying to show is that this is a top-down process where some research institutions together with big pharmaceutical companies are influencing the dominant topics that are being studied, those that most of the people will be looking at and also contributing to. Mm. So that's the background of the research in a way.
Definitely, definitely. And that makes sense. And that's why I think skewed is a good word for it. It's interesting too, because this is something that's been going on for a while, and you guys looked at data from 1999 to 2018, right? So that's that's a long time. So you can kind of at least, you know, see some trends. So in terms of that, and I know you guys divided that time into like two different ones, or like earlier and late, who did you see as, who are the key actors defining the research agenda?
So maybe I can just quickly say something, and then if you guys want to complete my answer. So an important thing to say is that throughout the whole period, so the 20 years of data we analyzed, big pharmaceutical companies were part of this dominant research agenda actors. So they work together with leading universities from the US, also from Europe, and mostly from core developed countries. In the second period, there are a few also Chinese institutions becoming more important, and some others, but mostly we're speaking of European and US, also some Canadian institutions working together with big pharma companies. What we see different from one period to the other is that the influence of big pharmaceutical companies expands. And we can see this because we are not only listing the institutions that are publishing the most in the journals with the highest impact factor within health and biomedical sciences, but we are also, as Marc-André was saying before, we also conducted a network analysis and built clusters grouping those institutions that publish the most together. We did this through a network analysis process that is done automatically. It's not that we decided who's going to be with whom. And the result that we found is that in the second period, the pharmaceutical companies, for instance, Roche, occupies a more central place in the network in terms of the number of clusters it connects. It's directly connected to a greater number of clusters than in the first period, which means that it is working together and therefore influencing the research of institutions that belong to different clusters, therefore to a broader network of institutions. Because we can think that while working, of course, with Roche, some of the universities are also working with other institutions.
Right.
And the agenda that was set together by certain universities working directly with big pharmaceutical companies in somehow will be expanded or will be unified with the different topics that are being worked on with other institutions. And when we speak of a research agenda, it's also important, and probably Mercedes can expand on this. The other relevant topic to have in mind is that the content of this research agenda was quite narrow. And this is another factor that allows us to,
I'm going to get into that question down the line, but I just wanted to, so maybe someone can clarify for my listeners, when you say the big pharma agenda, can you, like, when you say they're influencing, what are they doing? Are they paying researchers? Are they paying the schools to do this research? Can you be a little more specific on that?
Let me jump in for this one. Maybe before answering this question, another issue that is important, Cecilia mentioned the notion of impact factors of journals. So we need to do a little bit of sociology of science to better understand the field, basically. So what is very important for researchers in health and biomedical field, it's basically that there is this competition to be quoted as much as possible. So the more you're being quoted, the more you become a reference for other papers. Basically, this means your paper is more important. So the impact factor of a medical journal is based on this idea that, well, if we have a higher impact factor, basically our articles are being more quoted than other journals. So on this issue of impact factor, so we are in a field where every researchers are trying to get cited as much as possible. So what we did is we started with the most quoted journals, most quoted articles, in order to define what is the dominant science. Some might disagree, this is not a good way to measure. Absolutely, bibliometric measure like impact factors is maybe not the best way to measure science, but it is a way that is being used inside biomedical research by researchers themselves to compare each other. So this is part of the game. Okay. Now, in this field, the thing is, for us, the surprise was really the fact that we saw that the industry was financing some of this research and, in fact, are shaping what has become this dominant agenda. So most of the way this is being played, well, what we looked is mostly through co-authorships and research affiliations. So basically looking at different authors and who is part of the authors, and when you had people directly from the drug companies or funded by the drug companies.
Okay.
So drug companies can pay for the research, so provide research funds. But what we saw as well is that many times you directly have employees of the drug company that is directly working in the research project. So that's one thing. But what we see as well, there's something a bit more complex in terms of publication planning, for example. So you do have medical communication companies that are taking care of trying to maximize the impact factor of some of these articles.
I know, because I've worked for some. So I know, okay. I know that field very well. I've written some papers as a ghostwriter, and I'm like, and put somebody else's name on it. So very familiar with the marketing tactics. There's some ethical questions there too, probably. All right, so we talk about the key actors, and so now I know, and I know this was mentioned earlier. So the main content of the research agenda, what is making it into these high impact journals, or what are people seeing more of? What are the topics?
Yeah, this is really interesting because we saw that most of what makes it to this dominant agenda. It's a study of two diseases that we know that are highly prevalent among the population of globally, and also in certain countries like the US or European countries, such as cancer and cardiovascular diseases. We also know that these two areas of study represent a huge field of development for pharma companies
right.
to test and sell new drugs and to develop new drugs. So it's not so wild to see that these diseases are the most studies, but we also saw that they were studied from a molecular and cellular biology perspective. Diseases are studied, but not taking into account prevention or social and environmental factors that affect disease onset, but that they are studied mainly with the idea of a pharmacological intervention
right.
using different tools.
Right, right.
And, so, perhaps just add that even though we were expecting to find an importance of cancer and cardiovascular diseases, it was way more than what we expected. And other also relevant diseases in terms of global health, such as infectious diseases, and we started this research before the pandemic, actually, but now it is clearer than ever, we're completely marginalized. When you study a dominant research agenda, one should not only look at what's been done, what's part of that agenda, but also it is important to focus on what's left behind
right.
and the consequences of that. So an agenda that is too much focused on cancer, cardiovascular diseases, and that it is approaching these pathologies from a very narrow perspective, just focusing on its molecular or cellular aspects and mm-hmm. not on the more a more broad analysis on health, has right. consequences both in terms of how these diseases are tackled, but also on what happens with all other types of diseases or and healthcare issues.
Irina, I just would like to add, for me, that was the more the most depressing part of this research, or finding these results, in the sense that, we're talking about cancer and cardiovascular disease. I mean, these are very important fields. We need research there. But the thing is to see how concentrated, how dominant it is for the overall health and biomedical science. And the thing is, we know, for example, that for cancer right now, if you follow the works of Vinay Prashad, for example, an oncologist who's been discussing a lot of the issues of cancer drug prices, basically, right now, we're in a system, if you bring to the market a new anti-cancer drugs that provide no therapeutic advance as compared to other drugs that already exist, it can still be a huge commercial success. And you end up in a system, Chris McCabb, for example, was making the claim, is that, well, if you're an investor right now and you can invest in this magical solution for climate change or basically a new anti-cancer drug that will not provide any therapeutic advance as compared to what already exists, as an investor, you have all the incentive to invest in this insignificant anti-cancer drug, because you have way more chances to get your returns. And seeing how dominant, for example, cancer has become in terms of the dominant research agenda, for me was kind of surprising. When it comes to health research, what we know right now is that what is making a huge difference in terms of therapeutic advance, social determinants of health, looking at environmental issues, so environmental health, the impact of climate change, or, well, we stopped the analysis at 2018, but for example, analyzing potential pandemic,
Right.
It could have been fun if it was part of, if there was a bit more interest of looking at these issues.
Yeah. That's what I actually, a research project I worked on in public health school was the factors leading to emerging infectious diseases. And a lot of them were, the way we, interact with our environment, things like that. I wanted to go, you talked about there was so much focus on cancer and there was so much focus on heart disease. And I just want to
clarify this. Now, we know that sometimes bad things just happen and there's, you know, we can't control that. But we also know that there's a lot of, you know, you touched the social determinants of health and then also people's behavior and habits. And we know that obesity is a risk factor for both of those things. It's a risk factor for COVID-19. So was this research was mostly focused on treatment. Is that correct? Like getting out, maybe testing a new drug that you can get out there, which is important, but what percentage of research is focused at all on prevention?
It's really marginal. It's not at, I mean, we didn't, this is two things to highlight. The first one is that we're looking at the predominant research agenda. This doesn't mean that there's no researcher outside in, I don't know, some countries in the world working on prevention. We know that there are because we have colleagues working on those topics. We're looking at the agenda that is the dominant one, that is the most studied one, that receives most of the money.
Right.
And it is there where prevention is left completely behind. And why we can tell you completely behind, because there are no, the way we analyze the content of this research agenda, something we didn't say is that we analyze around 95,000 publications. Of course, we didn't read them all. We used big data analysis and text mining techniques to extract the most frequent terms that appeared in these 95,000 papers, abstracts, keywords, and titles. And none of those terms referred to prevention. So,
that's crazy.
So
that's disappointing.
it doesn't mean that in all these 95,000 papers, there was no work on prevention. It means that it was not among the most frequently conducted research. So this is also something important to say. It may be the case that every now and then you see a paper in Nature or Cell or Lancet that discusses about prevention, but that's not what you're going to see in most of the cases. So of course, we are using a methodology that focuses on what is prevalent, what is dominant.
Right.
And this is what we wanted to highlight. We are not neglecting, we do not want to be part of those neglecting the efforts of a lot of colleagues working precisely on this social determinants of health. Mercedes was saying in the beginning, actually she works on part of that as well. So that's of course not what we aim to do. What we aim to do with this research is to show that the way this dominant research agenda is being set, it's totally aligned to big pharmaceutical companies' interests, to economic interests, therefore, but it's not aligned to global health interests.
And this is well put. And to in a nutshell, if we can put this in other words, basically, what we saw is this dominant research agenda in health and biomedical science is focused on financial returns first and foremost, and not necessarily on therapeutic returns, basically. Or the focus is not on what would be offering the best therapeutic advance, for example, with neglected diseases, etc., but really focus on the research niche where you have higher financial returns. And this is where, for me, the results were a bit depressing.
And maybe what is one quick extra thing is that someone could say, okay, if overall it's pharma companies that are funding all this research, then okay, they have the right to influence the research lines, the research agenda. But let me just relate our results to other results that I published elsewhere, where I show actually that in the funding sources declared by pharmaceutical companies in their publications, so scientific articles published at least by one co-author coming from a big pharmaceutical company, and I analyzed the cases of Roche, Novartis, and Pfizer. And among the most frequent funding sources for the three cases, of course, it started with the own company. So if I was looking at Roche, then the most frequent funding source was Roche, and so on. But in the three cases, the second most frequent funding source was the US NIH. And then we, in the list, there were a lot of public funding agencies from different global north countries. So it's not only research that is being funded by the pharma companies. It's research that is actually mostly being funded by public sources, therefore by taxpayers' money. Therefore, we are all paying for research that is not coping with our expectations for a healthier life and the consequences. Of course, we cannot establish direct relations because we cannot do such a counterfactual analysis. But definitely, we need to change this research agenda if we want to prevent future pandemics.
And I think too, when you said that there's a lot of publicly funded research, and this goes back to, I think, the 1980s, when at least here in the US, a lot of taxpayers are funding that research. And then if those drugs, if they study drugs, for example, and they're successful in clinical trials, they go on to get approval by FDA, the taxpayers don't get like a return on that. And that's one of the arguments for a lot of people here who are promoting like Medicare for all. They're like, well, if this is tax funded research, you know, why then do we have to pay such a huge amount of money? And I think there's some merit in the question that they're asking.
Absolutely. And so two things here. What I like about our study is that, so that includes basically indirect influence in the sense that you might have public money that is so by different research institutions, but what we see is that they do align with the priorities of the industry agenda, let's say. So what we saw in terms of shaping the priorities of research agenda global level, industry is part of that, but the thing is then public research institutions end up aligning with this, with different partnerships, et cetera. But this is an excellent question you're asking in terms of, if we have public money that is doing the research, why do we end up with paying for these drugs at super high costs? I saw yesterday the release by the General Accounting Office, of the price of prescription drugs in the United States. Looking at United States versus France, Australia, and Canada, and basically the prices are costing on average for brand name drugs 4 times more in the United States as compared to Australia, Canada, or France. So basically, as somebody in the United States that has drug coverage for 75% of their drug cost, they end up paying more than somebody with no coverage at all in countries like Canada, Australia, or France. If you look, for example, at the vaccines, I mean, the Moderna vaccine, there was no private money invested for this vaccine. This was all public money. And you end up with Moderna asking $20 a dose for the vaccine, which is absolutely huge. The cost of production is more like $2-3 a dose, but still, they managed to basically capture the public research in order to bring the product to the market. So they don't pay for the research and they end up making huge profits afterwards by the huge markups they're asking on the price of the drug.
Yeah, and I haven't followed the vaccine pricing too. I know there's a lot of discussion there, but you're right. Like if they decide, like, especially if like, you know, boosters are in our future, there's a question that's still up in the air. Like how much is that going to cost people? And then there's talks about getting rid of those patents and letting other countries have, the formula, so to speak, which, you know, I support, but it's just a lot of decisions you have to think. And I think a lot of people are like, well, how much of, everything is just profit motivated? Because that's the big question, right? Like, are we putting profit over patients?
I think that's something really interesting. And the COVID vaccine is a great example of if that's happening. Because even in I believe even in countries when you have a public health governments have to make agreements and buy the vaccines off from big pharma companies, and they end up spending a lot of resources and making huge agreements for vaccines that are not so like readily available for all the population. For example, it's the case here in Argentina. We even have Argentina makes the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine here in Argentina, but none of the doses that were made in Argentina were given in Argentina. They all went, they were all shipped to Mexico, and they are not being distributed here, even though the government not only paid for doses, but also paid for the Argentinian private company that is making the vaccine here. The government gave them funds in order to start their production.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a big scandal, and precisely with the Oxford vaccine, and let me emphasize the Oxford vaccine, because actually the research was done by Oxford. It was 97% funded with public funds. Nevertheless, and in part due to the pressures of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Oxford finally decided that it was going to be AstraZeneca, the only holder of the rights to produce this vaccine and distribute it. And it was AstraZeneca who conducted the clinical trials. So typically one forgets, because we end up seeing or focusing on who's getting the profits, but we should also look at who actually conducted the research that resulted in the vaccine. And in the case of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, it was a public university. Right. And this is also part of the issue we are facing in terms of public health. We have public research that afterwards has been appropriated by private companies, and then the public sector buys again those results. So it's funding for things that then it needs to buy all over again. Yeah. So it's twice the expense. Yeah. And it's crazy, but it's happening.
I mean, but when you think about that model, right, for the drug companies, I mean, what a model.
It makes no sense. You explain it and make no sense, and it's still there. So it's clear that there are very powerful interests underlying what's going on, and that's crystal clear.
Now, do you think, I mean, one of the arguments a lot of people say, or like, you know, like in the US when all these laws were passed in the 1980s during like the Reagan era, it was, well, we weren't making any drugs, and everything was kind of slowed down. So we did this to kind of stimulate these drugs and to get, you know, into advance research. But it's sort of like kind of crossed into a new territory now, right? Like it's sort of like we kind of have to find a better equilibrium, I think.
So in the 1980s, under the Reagan administration, basically with the Bayh-Dole Act, for example, it was a lot about, okay, let's make industry and academy work together. So let's establish these partnerships. But the thing is, okay, let's reorganize the way we're doing academic science with a focus on trying to get patents, basically. So bring in the old idea of intellectual property inside academics departments. And the thing is, I mean, patents can be super interesting. They provide great incentives for specific research niche. And we need to accept that's true. But the thing is, for other types of research niche, patents are absolutely not the right type of incentives in order to favor this type of research. But the thing is, since the 1980s, we completely changed the culture of academics, of researchers, where we have more and more this focus on, well, getting financial returns. So for me, it's just, this is not something we look in the article, but I do think this is one of the reasons why we end up with this type of results, with this type of dominant research agenda that are focusing on financial returns. But the thing is, what we've been seeing, for example, in the last year with COVID, is a bit of a return of what we call open science. But open science, basically, it's the way we're doing science in the 1970s, based on collaboration, on sharing data, sharing knowledge, with way less focus on intellectual property. Right. And that was super interesting because at the beginning of COVID-19, the whole sequencing of the genome of the virus and then the evolution of the virus with different variants, that was all done through open science. Right. Personal protection equipment as well. So all the sharing of data based on open science. But when it came to producing the vaccine, it's just, no, this is an important market niche. So then everything went back into proprietary science. Yeah. And we end up with now a handful of companies that have control over the five different vaccines right now. And most of the research publicly funded, but with major drug companies refusing to share the knowledge behind these vaccines in order to allow more production at the global scale. For example, in Canada, we have three companies that have been asking for months saying, we do have a supply line for vaccines that is ready to use. We can put it to use in order to produce mRNA vaccine or the AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We can put it to use. But the thing is, this is not interesting for a larger company, so they're not building any licensing agreement. And we end up with a lot of our manufacturing capacity, well, in Canada or in many countries, we think about South Africa, India, or even at Argentina. And these manufacturing capacity are not being put to use right now in order to make sure that some companies maintain the control over expertise, knowledge, know-how over some vaccine.
Let me just add to complement Marc-André's answer, which I fully agree, that the intellectual property rights system was supposed to fulfill two promises. One was that it was supposed to give some form of price or incentive to inventors. The other one was that it was going to help to disclose, to make knowledge explicit and to limit tacit knowledge, secrecy, what was kept inside the company. And none of this became a reality. First, because the owner of those and that are the patent assignees are not the patent inventors. So the people inventing the patent or the institutions inventing the patent end up not being those that are profiting from the price or the reward. Right. And just to give you one stylized fact about that, the top 2,000 companies in terms of business expenditure and R&D concentrate 60% of the total IP5 patents, which means the results that were patented in the five largest patent offices. So there is a big concentration of patent ownership. And on top of that, and concerning the disclosement of the information, if you read a patent, you will probably not be able to actually reproduce what has been patented. They just disclose very, very few information and keep most of it still secret so that you end up obliged to pay the royalties to get the extra information that is not disclosed on the patent document. Yeah. So it's not a way to make science public or inventions public, and it's not a way to reward those inventing new things, but it's actually a way that contributes to concentrating wealth in fewer hands.
And I think, Mark, you touched on this earlier when you talked about kind of like the Me Too drugs, where like they can still be super profitable, but not they don't necessarily show a better and improved therapeutic value. They don't add that. And I think the same is true, like with the patents, right? Like there's ways to kind of extend these patents to like ridiculous lengths by just like changing something very slightly. It doesn't really do much, but all of a sudden you have more years to your patent. So you can't, you know, you're not going to become a generic drug now. So you get like 5 more years or 10 more years of protection.
Well, yes, absolutely. So the Me Too drugs and patent extension, what we call evergreening, has been central in terms of the different corporate strategies to increase returns without necessarily providing anything new in terms of the research, in terms of therapeutic benefits. But we need to keep in mind as well that one of the important market niche that we see right now, it's drugs for rare disease. So the orphan drugs have become the new form of blockbuster. It's just, yes, normally you can simply, you have a handful of patients that require this drug, but you can charge prices that are so high. Yeah. So it can still become a blockbuster. And the thing is, and what we're seeing as well is what has become for me the normal way of doing research. It's just, well, the basic research is being done publicly first and foremost in public research institutions, university, etc. And as soon as we find something promising, well, with Betalac, you end up with, okay, let's create a startup company inside the university that will appropriate basically all the research in order to develop a silver bullet, basically. And so you bring this in phase 1, phase 2 clinical trial, but the purpose of this startup is to be acquired by a larger company that is dominant on the global networks in terms of market access in different countries. So what we're seeing right now is that we have a lot of these new orphan drugs produced based on public research, sometimes for a price that would not be that high. Yeah. But the thing is, then the company is acquired by a larger company that will make sure you have the highest price possible for this specific drug. But the contribution is not always very significant from the major drug company that is making all the returns on.
You know, people always say follow the money. And then, you know, you like to have this very kind of pure vision of science. But you know, when your motivation from the beginning is profit, you know, it just makes a lot of people wonder. And I think that's also like a lot of people are very distrustful, you know, of drug companies and even conventional medicine, whether they should be or not, depending on the circumstance. But I think like if we could make this system better and more transparent and more people patient focused versus profit, like it would just benefit humanity, but I don't know. I don't know if we're going to get there. What do you guys think?
I totally believe that. I think sometimes people, this is not mentioned enough, but people have the, especially patients, have the ability and should organize themselves in order to see how their health is managed, you know? Yeah. Especially in less frequent diseases, I think that sort of like the organization of patients, it's so powerful in terms of being able to access new treatments, managing also disease from another perspective that involves environmental factors or well-being. That I think it's what big pharma companies and the sort of like hegemonical medical system doesn't do. So I think that sort of like self-organization into a patient communities and also discussion with the general public, it's like really important in all this.
And I also think too, like how much of this dominant, in your guys' opinion, this dominant research agenda, is it biasing the standards of care? I know, what do you guys think about that?
Cecilia, one last word before you go.
She has to sign off, yeah.
I'm still here, but I'm almost leaving. Just say that I think that on the one hand, it is indeed skewing our, and as our research shows, the effect of the dominant research agenda goes beyond the dominant research agenda. And we also started conducting some research on how this dominant research agenda influences other research agendas, for instance, from semi-peripheral countries like Argentina. But But on top of that, we should say, and in line with what Mercedes was saying, that there are a lot of counter initiatives or counter tendencies or attempts to overcome this way of doing research. And Marc-André was mentioning before that the pandemic also gave researchers an opportunity to go back to a more collaborative and less competitive way of working. And I think this is also part of what should be embraced, because we need also to change the mindset. And there is this mindset that there are some things that are better done by private firms, for instance, and we don't even give it a try to do it publicly and collaboratively. And there's also this idea that the best research is the research that is competitive with others instead of research that collaborates with others. And in fact, knowledge is a cumulative process. We build on others all the time. So why should we think that that competition is better than actually collaborating with others and building together? So basically, I think that my word of hope would be along those lines.
Thank you. I know you have to run, but I just want to thank you so much for joining today. Very insightful.
Thank you. Thanks to you. And I'm sorry I need to leave before you end. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Ceci, it was a pleasure. Take good care, and I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, the same thing here. All the best to you and to you too, Mercedes.
Have a
thanks, Erin.
Yeah. Nice meeting you. Sort of. So I guess so you guys would probably say, and I just have like maybe like 1.5 more questions.
but Erin, I wanted to say maybe 2 things to your last question. So I think one of the big issue that we have when it comes to biomedical research is that it's the way we measure innovation. So if we measure innovation based on financial return, so innovation is good if it creates money, or we measure sometimes innovation based on the number of patents that are being produced, these are financial measurement. This is not about health results, and this is something very problematic. And going back in terms of what does that mean for the organization of healthcare, you know, yesterday when Joe Biden in his speech so mentioned, for example, the need for Medicare Part D to start negotiating drug prices. I'm Canadian, and I absolutely hope that the United States will start doing that. We need to understand Medicare Part D represent 10% of the global market for prescription drugs, not of the American market, 10% of the global market. And you have a system that says, we're going to pay for anything at any price. So bring us any crap you want, and basically we'll pay for that. This is nonsense. If you want to make sure that you get value for money, well, you need to do a bit of discrimination in order to say, well, this drug doesn't bring anything in terms of therapeutic advance, so we must refuse to pay more dollar for a new drug that is not providing any of these therapeutic additional therapeutic benefits. As long as we do not do that, we end up with a global market for drugs where supply and demand becomes very problematic. If you have a demand side that says we will pay for anything at any price, this is a bit the El Dorado of economic theory, where you basically demand buys for everything. And it reflects in the way the supply is organized and the research is organized as well, focusing on things that might not offer the best therapeutic advance because the financial incentives are not aligning in the right direction, basically.
Wow. Yeah, it's just, so what, I guess like a, so, you know, obviously like there's an issue here, and I think your paper is great in that it helps bring awareness to this issue. And we've known about, you know, conflicts of interest and that kind of thing for a long time. Is there a way to make the dominant research agenda in the future more balanced, or more focused on improving health and the patient versus this, like what steps could, are there any practical steps that people could take?
That's a tough question.
It is.
I do think that as long as we measure innovation based on financial returns, this will not be possible. As long as we measure a researcher's success based on the number of quotes and references, basically based on impact factors, the way we're doing right now, I think we end up with the same problem when we see that these dominant research agenda are greatly influenced basically by the industry. What I think we need is to open the door to other ways of doing science, basically, other epistemological approach that might be focusing more on the social dimension or the ecological dimension, environmental dimension of health. And for me, as long as we have a market for prescription drugs where we're not trying to obtain value for money and we accept to pay for things that provide no therapeutic value, basically we're stuck in this situation. And I think that in terms of global agenda, if we can start with the promise that was done yesterday by Joe Biden in terms of negotiating prices in order to obtain money for value with Medicare Part D, this is 10% of the global market. This is one step in the right direction.
Okay, one practical step. Mercedes, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, sometimes it is a tough question because sometimes sort of like all these type of questions have the same answer really, but in my opinion, behind, which is making a radical change in the conditions that we live in, you know? If there's a system, a scientific research system that pushes certain topics in front of or prioritizes certain type of research instead of other, One might have the intention of doing something that goes against the system, but sometimes you are also penalized for doing so, and getting grants becomes difficult, yeah. And you are like a little fish swimming against a huge current,
yeah. And
it becomes so difficult, you know? I mean, it does happen, you know, many people try to research from different epistemological approaches, and we are all doing our research work out there and trying to make an impact. But it also has to do with sort of like demanding for better conditions, better work conditions, better healthcare. And so I think we need like to make a more substantial change. And I know that sometimes it seems that sort of like all my answers maybe sort of like are in capitalism. But the system is so rotten that people are dying because they go to work, dying of COVID, dying of other diseases.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
But I think sometimes fighting for, I mean, there's, of course, one can fight for different things inside the system, and there sometimes people win, you know, in many, for example, in many countries, certain pesticides have been banned due to the fact that people fought against it. Same with fracking or other activities that are very bad towards health and towards the environment. Sometimes people can get organized, sort of like direct action, in my opinion, sometimes it's like the best way of changing the system, you know, and to fight against injustice.
Yeah, it's tough. And we need to talk about the pesticides. That battle is still going on over here.
Erin, I think my fever is coming back.
Oh God. Oh no, I'm sorry. That was, I was at the end. I have to sign on to another meeting that I'm actually a little bit late for now, but I want to give you guys, do you have any closing thoughts, or that could be your closing thought?
I think, I said everything I had to say.
It was great. It was really, really well done. And I want to thank you both for your time. And I look forward to sharing this with my listeners and getting their feedback too. And I like that it was very global.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, and you guys take care with the, you know, with all the COVID stuff. I know you just had your vaccine. I don't know how it is in Argentina.
No, we are like amidst a huge crisis similar to what happened in Brazil. We are facing more restrictions. Probably they are going to be announced in a couple more hours. We have already like time is restricted. Transport is restricted only to essential workers. But it seems that there will be more restrictions because all the beds in hospitals are occupied and the health system is about to reach a collapse. It's already at full capacity and it's very close to collapsing.
Oh, God.
So the situation is so bad at this point.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know. You mentioned the vaccines in the beginning. I hope you guys can get more of them or get some.
Yes.
But one of the big issues with the vaccine is that it's the export ban from the United States. So basically this is the largest world factory right now because most of the vaccines are coming from the United States. But the United States said, well, we're not exporting anything as long as everybody here is not vaccinated. So that creates these huge imbalance. Canada, we did manage to get a lot of supply from Europe, so things are not so bad.
Yeah.
But other countries, this is...
I hope the President Biden does, because like we're about to hit more supply than demand. So I think instead of... Because there's just people in the U.S. who are not going to get the vaccine unless you like hold them down and stick it in them. That's just where we're at. So I think... exporting to other, getting your highest risk people vaccinated, that should be our goal. I hope. I know he changed his stance on India, where he is going to send some stuff over there. I'm not exactly sure what, but hopefully we lift that. It makes sense to, even from a selfish purpose, right? Like if we're helping other countries, like this is a pandemic, it's airborne. It can easily hop from one country to the next. So even from that selfish perspective that, you know, the U.S. is kind of known for, unfortunately. But,
And New York saw, like, New York City saw a rough time in the beginning of the pandemic.
But now we're good.
Okay, but...
Yeah.
I imagine the world doesn't want to see those images. We don't want to see them over and over again in different countries. Nonetheless, that is what it is happening.
Yeah.
Seeing... hospitals collapsing, resources sort of like exhausted. I believe no one wants to see that, but well, sometimes things are not so easy.
No. Well, I don't know if he listens to my podcast. Probably not, but maybe.
I will do so now.
He grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I grew up in a town like 20 minutes from there. So maybe.
Oh, wow.
Well,
good luck, Karen, with the podcast. It was a pleasure to discuss with you. Mercedes, always a pleasure to see you, and I hope we'll see each other in person very soon as well.
Yeah, thank you both, guys.
So.
Thanks so much. I hope you and hope everything gets better. Let's all hope for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, guys, thank you so much for tuning in and listening. Hopefully you found that interesting. I hope you guys subscribe and share this podcast. And if you have any suggestions, you can always reach me on Facebook, Instagram, @Dr. Eakes, Twitter, I think that's it, YouTube, email. And one of those ways, and I'll answer. But yeah, I hope you do stick around. Definitely subscribe, and we shall talk soon. Bye-bye, guys. Enjoy the rest of your day wherever you may be.